Hello and welcome back to the NovPod, your beginner's guide to obstetric anaesthetics. My name is Owen Dorr, I'm one of your co-hosts, and this podcast is brought to you in association with the Royal College of Anaesthetists and the Obstetric Anaesthetists Association. This is the last episode in this mini-series, and we bring you probably one of the most important conversations that we've had in the NovPod series. We are on to the support project, which is supporting parents and professionals through neonatal resuscitation in theatre. Duncan and I are joined by Dr. Esther Godfrey, who's not only a brilliant anaesthetist and intensivist, but has also brought her own personal story to this podcast and is one of the co-founders of the support project. During this episode, Esther will make reference to an infographic which is pending publication. We will share a link to her website where it will be uploaded when it does get published. Lastly, as you might expect for such a sensitive podcast topic, there are some areas and discussions that listeners might find distressing, so I'd really advise that you come to it when you feel that the time is right. And without further ado, we'll go on to the episode.
I have to say, this is probably the trickiest opening.
Well, that's why I wanted to maybe talk about recent difficult conversations on labour ward as an opener.
Yeah.
So I'm not even on an obstetric block at the moment. I'm SR on call. And still in the last fortnight, it's been proven that obstetrics is like the hardest area of communication, I think, within anaesthetics. I don't know if you guys agree. You've got no time. You've often got clinical urgency. And you've got young people that are usually fit, usually used to being well, and they are shown their mortality, aren't they?
Yeah.
And they're suddenly faced with being poorly or their baby being poorly, and they're incredibly anxious, and you have to do things pretty rapidly, don't you? So in the last fortnight, got called up for a Category 1 C-section. They're already operating next door, so opening a second theatre. Lady arrives in from triage, fetal bradycardia, very little English, comes up. You know, you've got almost no history. Had to basically take an allergy status, find out if she had any medical problems, try and consent someone when you don't know whether they understand what's going on, and put someone off to sleep for an emergency C-section. And it felt like, for that woman, probably an incredibly traumatising situation. No time for language line.
Yeah.
You know, it was just brief and being safe as you can. And it felt a bit inadequate, but it was what it was. And the baby was well, you know.
Yeah.
And she was well. And it was managed well. I've had to, in the last fortnight, step into a room with a lady with an intrauterine death at 35 weeks, do an epidural that they were struggling with, the junior was struggling with. Try and be your most compassionate self. Appreciate that that woman is going through the hardest time of her life in that room, and you need to get a procedure done. So I think it spans many different things, doesn't it? Even taking consent in labour. What a nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't it?
Even if you're waiting for contractions to pass, how much is going in?
You feel like you're consenting the partner because they're the one in the room listening.
Yeah.
I've consented a woman before who was a lawyer, a medical negligence lawyer.
Yeah,
thinking,
great.
Yeah. Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
And you just do the best you can, don't you?
Yeah.
But labour ward is fraught with difficult communication.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's why I'm keen to talk to you about it today, really.
You've come up on quite a few things we've touched on in the series so far. The challenge of being parachuted in to an emergency situation, having to be reactive when you want to be proactive and you can't do that, and then doing the best you can rather than what you would want to do.
Yeah, for sure.
To try and get a good outcome.
Yeah, I think it, you know, when your timing has to be rapid, you have to really hone down on the salient points, don't you? And to try and get a very quick history and be safe, but not take too much time. It's such a balance. And often mum's a bit poorly as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you're a bit stressed about the fact that you have to get things done rapidly but safely.
Yeah.
And there's a partner. And they're probably frightened, right, for their other half and the baby.
Yeah.
And there's two people for them to consider.
And it's something that we can, as you've mentioned there, have a huge impact on as an anaesthetist. But we are people who are doing extraordinary things, not extraordinary humans doing extraordinary things. And we need to remember that we will have a lot on our minds in terms of trying to do procedures, communicate with our MDT, but that communication with the mum and the partner can have a huge impact on that ongoing long-term health. You can't remove the trauma from an experience, but you can try and make it as smooth as possible for them. And there's quite a lot of evidence of a high birth trauma experience rate amongst people who deliver them. Some of the factors that can influence that is poor staff interaction, part not being communicated, feeling that they were helpless, and trying to get them along with that journey can have real benefits. What you're mentioning there about what you've gone on in the past 2 weeks is bringing cases back to my mind of similar but very different conversations. And these are things that not only will be important during your novice in period, but we hope that we've got some other people listening in as well that who work in obstetric anaesthetics. It carries on. This is a lifelong journey and learning about what communication works for what type of person.
Absolutely.
As part of this difficult conversations on labour wards topic, you're the co-founder of a fantastic project in Wales called the Support Project, which is looking at communication between parents and professionals when there's neonatal resuscitation happening in theatre. So what is the project and why did you think it was important to start it?
So the Support Project stands for supporting parents and professionals through neonatal resuscitation in obstetric theatre. And it's very specifically honing down on that experience and that interaction between healthcare professionals and the mum and the birth partner during that period when a baby's born poorly. So it's come from a personal experience. I talk to people a lot about my story. Many people have heard about Juno, my daughter. And I really talk not as an anaesthetist, but as a mum and as someone that's gone through being a patient. But I feel privileged that I'm an anaesthetist as well, and I can offer both perspectives and I can see both sides of the story. And that's kind of why I ended up bringing this project into being, is feeling unique and that I'm a mum and an anaesthetist and I can understand both perspectives. So to go through my own story, in 2017 I was an ST3 anaesthetic trainee and ITU registrar, and I got pregnant with my first child, and I was probably a really annoying yoga going mum to be. And I actually enjoyed being pregnant and it treated me quite well, apart from being massive and all the recovery nurses telling me that I'd put weight on my face, which was lovely. And
Very nice.
It's what every woman ever wants to hear, right? And I did all the things that you usually do. I got to term and beyond, term plus four, and was eating pineapple and curry and raspberry leaf tea. And I was midwifery-led care and everything looked really straightforward. But I'd done obstetric anaesthesia and I knew that things didn't always go to plan. And my birth plan had been aim for the water, go with the flow, have what I need. If I need an epidural, rock on, you know, I'll have one. And do what's needed to keep me and my baby safe. Essentially, that was my birth plan. And I went into labour at term plus four and Juno had a fetal tachycardia. I flagged on like the maternal sepsis bundle, went on to antibiotics, had some fluids, had an epidural, which was marvellous. And I'm ever grateful to my anaesthetist for giving me fabulous pain relief. And she had this persistent fetal tachycardia and I went through labour, got to 10 centimetres. I tried pushing and then had a trial with an epidural top-up and then ended up having a Category 2 caesarean section. It should have been earlier, so there was some things missed in terms of signs of distress. It wasn't really picked up on, and in like the Swiss cheese model of care, I kind of went through the holes of the cheese, and she should have been born at about midday, but she was born at 7 p.m. And so people didn't realise how bad things were, really. So in theatre, I very suddenly went from thinking I was having a fairly healthy baby girl, thought she might need some IV antibiotics, thought she might need to go, you know, with the paediatricians for a bit, have an IV line. But I didn't realise she'd be born really poorly. And she was born floppy and blue and barely breathing, really, with very low apgars. And went over to the resuscitaire, and I just had the biggest shock of my life, you know. And it was completely unexpected to find myself a mum of a critically ill baby. And the silence really was deafening. It's quite a cliche, but, you know, I just couldn't hear any crying. And that's what everyone's expecting, right? Mm. And that's what you're really aware of as anaesthetist, isn't it?
Yeah.
When the baby's not crying, parents are listening out for it.
Yeah.
And you know it will be unsettling, and it is unsettling, and it's scary. And I felt quite pinned to the bed. I had a really high epidural top-up, I had tingly fingers, and I was septic and felt a bit grim. And I think my blood pressure was a bit rubbish. But I felt pinned to the bed, and the resuscitaire was behind me, so I couldn't see what was going on. And it was my anaesthetist that I relied on to tell me what was happening. And she was great. You know, she told me they were helping with her breathing, that she had meconium aspiration, that she was being intubated. And she kept me informed. And that was what I needed in that moment, you know, was to be told what was happening when I couldn't see. And then we got a drive-by on the way up to the NICU. So I got to see her in the incubator. She was being ventilated. And then she went up to the neonatal intensive care unit, and I had my ongoing cesarean section. And our theatre experience was not all bad at all. There were some really good things about it, and there were some things that had quite a bit of damage in terms of, you know, the communication skills. My anaesthetist was actually great, but some of the communication wasn't so great. And it kind of, that stayed with me quite a while, and you find yourself in a therapy suite talking about it, you know, many months and maybe a couple of years down the line. So what we do and what we don't do in that minute, even though it's a very fleeting period of time, can have a huge impact ongoing for that parent. And what I would say is that people remember your words, and they may remember your words word for word.
Yeah.
Which is a scary thought, because it's a huge responsibility to carry, isn't it? And I kind of think we can't worry about that too much, but we just need to choose what we say wisely and try and be our most compassionate selves in that moment, because even though it's just a fleeting moment of time, that may be, for that family, the most scary period in their entire lives. I like to kind of complete Juno's story, if that's okay.
Just, please do, yes.
She spent 2 days on the neonatal unit, but she was too septic to survive, and they threw the book at her on NICU. They gave her everything, my gosh, like every blood transfusion and every antibiotic, and she wasn't a candidate for ECMO because she had hypoxic encephalopathy. And she died in our arms at 2 days old. And I would say that I sort of brushed off my birth trauma as a more minor part. You know, when I was in that early grief, I just couldn't see past it. But as I've learnt to live aside my grief, I realised there was a lot of trauma that came from that period of resuscitation in theatre. And I headed back to work, and it was Nicola Harris, who's a co-founder of the project, who, after some time and giving me some time, was asking me, she said, Esther, what do parents want when they're in theatre with a poorly baby? Because I have people asking me, I have ODPs and trainees asking me, what should I say? And I just would like to know what you think is the answer. And I thought, well, I know what I want, but I'm an anaesthetist and I probably don't represent the UK population. And so that's sort of how the project was born, was that then we invited parents from across the UK to give their experiences of you know, having had neonatal resuscitation in theatre, what did they want? What information did they want from their healthcare professionals? And then we expanded the project to involve staff and to find out what is happening currently. What are we doing as anaesthetists and ODPs? What do we currently, you know, communicate with families, and how variable is it between healthcare professionals? So that's sort of the birth of the project. And it started small, and poor Nikki, I think she just wanted some guidance, a small guide, but it spiraled into something much bigger because we found out that there's no literature out there and that there's no knowledge and how we actually know what constitutes high quality communication. We don't actually know. So we felt that we had to find that out. Otherwise we're doing the area a disservice.
Yeah.
And thank you for that beautiful and very powerful story of yourself and Juno. I feel emotional now even hearing it. I think now for it's not the first time I've heard it. But,
yeah.
And I think what you've touched upon there on that minute that we have is a absolute privilege, and that's why we go into work, is to make people's journeys through anaesthesia better. And on this particular one, it's an area where we haven't actually, as you say, dedicated much literature resource, and it is, well, I've tried to read the research that we've tried to do for the podcast hasn't turned up much, as you might know, and why today's episode is going to be really helpful for people to help nudge the conversation in the right direction to help that reduce the effect of that birth trauma for that mum that's in front of them right then and there.
Mediplus has been working alongside anaesthetists for over 20 years, creating innovative devices you use every day. Focus on your patients, knowing you have reliable equipment by your side. Our market-leading dedicated Teva sets inspire confidence so you can concentrate on what matters most. Don't take our word for it. Talk to your colleagues and discover the Mediplus difference. Visit us at www.mediplusuk.com to learn more.
In terms of the support project, what's happening with it at the moment? So the aims of the project are to improve communication between, well, the mum in front of the man, between staff themselves. And what stage are you guys at the moment?
Well, it's become a research project, but we really want it to be more than that and be a quality improvement project. And, you know, the whole point of it is to drive up standards. So not just be a piece of publication that no one reads, you know, yeah, a 44-page document that is unmanageable.
Yeah.
We want it to be something pragmatic. And so we've sort of synthesised the parental experiences and the staff experiences and what we're currently doing and what constitutes good quality communication into an infographic. My hope and our hope for the project is that we would hopefully see that by the side of an anaesthetic machine in every UK obstetric theatre across the country. We're just at the point where we are finalising the infographic with some advice, and we'll talk that through in a bit, some of the points from it. But essentially, we need to go back to parents now and staff. We're kind of aware that we've probably sampled parents who are white, middle class, engaged with social media, and we have their views, and we have a Wales-wide staff view of what the anaesthetic team are doing, but we're really keen to figure out whether we're going to be doing what is right for a diverse population. So the next step is to go back to a socioeconomic diverse group and to take this infographic and what we're proposing that anaesthetists should do and make sure essentially that they think across multiple populations that it's the right way to go. So we want to talk to staff about it and parents that have experienced neonatal resus, because I think you could talk to parents about it that haven't been through it, but how on earth do you know what you want in that situation. The best thing is to go to parents that have had to live through it. What I would say is that I am on the severe end of a spectrum. So, you know, Juno had proper neonatal resuscitation. She didn't have chest compressions, but, you know, she needed ventilating to go to NICU. That is the severe end. But for parents, even needing a bit of CPAP is highly traumatic. So, you know, when we're, as anaesthetists, we're so used to seeing babies get a little bit of CPAP, bit of shaking down with a towel, and we don't think that much of that, I would say. You know, that's on the less severe end of the spectrum. But for that family, that's a major thing and completely unexpected to have any breathing support. So that can be highly traumatic, even though we don't see it as such. So this project hopefully is for all of that, not just for the severe end of the spectrum. It's to appreciate for that moment of time that the baby is having any amount of support is highly traumatising for parents, and what we can say to make things a bit better.
And kind of going on from that, from the results of asking staff and parents, you being on both sides of that, did you find anything particularly stood out that resonated with your experience, or anything that you felt was a very important thing that at the time you didn't realise was important?
Gosh, you know, I found it highly emotional going through the parental data, because, you know, it's really quite difficult seeing how many stories there were and how impacted mums were by this small period of time. What I would say is that I was worried that parents want very different things. And a concern that I had was that we would get data back that would essentially say everyone wants something different and we can't do anything right for everyone. But thankfully, we are largely wanting the same things. And people did actually want a similar approach to me, even though I'm an anaesthetist and a doctor and I'm only a certain type of person. People do want information. They do want it simple. You know, they do want all the things that I wanted. There are certain things that were picked up on that I didn't pick up on because I'm a doctor, so I'm grateful that I sampled them. So, for example, medical jargon. So lots of parents talking about bagging, lots of parents talking about my baby being bagged. They didn't know what that meant. They don't know if their baby's being put in a bag. Tesco bag for life. That's something that didn't hit home with me because I know what bagging is, but they don't. So I'm grateful that we have had non-doctor people and parents from different walks of life to give their experiences, because it hits home how some of what we say is nonsense, isn't it?
Yeah.
And like you said earlier, Owen, the resuscitaire, no, people not knowing what that is, what it's for. There's things that we assume as medical professionals that parents know.
I was just going to ask about your own experience. Please don't feel inclined to answer, but, you know, hindsight is maybe a different thing looking back now. But do you think that your anaesthetist using the medical jargon and you being on knowing the medical jargon helped you in the initial phase of what was going on not have the trauma initially? And so you were focused on the medical thing, and then actually that potentially delayed things later? Or did that alter how you processed, do you think?
I don't think that my anaesthetist did use medical jargon with me, but I wouldn't have even noticed if she'd have said bagging. I don't think she did. I do think we have to be mindful of the impact of what we say. So as Juno was being driven by on the way up to the neonatal unit, someone very fleetingly said, and I don't know who said this, maybe neonatal doctor or someone from that team, said, we're taking Juno up to the NICU for her brain to be cooled, and then took her away. And I think that may have gone over the head of someone who wasn't medical. Yeah. But for me, that was devastating, because essentially someone was telling me that my baby had brain damage.
Yeah.
And that they needed cooling of their brain. And so I knew she had hypoxic brain injury. whether that actually was worse for me in some ways as a doctor because I know too much, and whether someone else might have thought cooling for the brain was bog standard. Yeah. I don't know. So there's ways that impacts me that I don't even know how it impacts other people. I certainly appreciated suddenly how sick I was, and I was terrible at being a patient. After the operation, we both had E. coli chorioamnionitis and E. coli bacteremia and septicemia, and then I had also a superadded cellulitis that was rapidly spreading over my C-section wound. And I was drawing around it, right? Because, you know, as doctors, we're like, terrible. We want to do everything for ourselves, isn't it? I was drawing around it and drawing around it. It was getting bigger. I actually thought I was going to die. So the day after Juno passed away, I thought, this E. coli has killed my baby, and I'm seriously concerned for myself. And I was on strong IV antibiotics, went home. So, yeah, I don't know how being an anaesthetist impacts me. In some ways, it makes things worse. And in some ways, it made things better. I think in terms of feeling powerless, it would be even worse to not be a doctor and someone that knows the obstetric world. I at least knew what it's like to be in an obstetric theatre, to have a C-section. I knew what was expected. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I knew the process. And to not know the process would have, I think, been even scarier in theatre. So undoubtedly, I think I felt powerless in that situation and like my life had been thrown up and derailed. And I think that that feeling of vulnerability would have been even worse if I wasn't a doctor.
Absolutely. What advice can we give to novice obstetric anaesthetists from the support project, particularly things like why do we need to focus on communication? We've kind of touched on it already, but just to reiterate.
I think what I would say is that it's actually quite common that babies will need some form of resuscitation. 10% of all babies born in hospital will need some help of some kind. Usually it's on the more mild end of the spectrum, thankfully. But even, as I was saying, even CPAP could be seen as a major intervention for a family and they can be traumatised by it. We know that poor quality interactions have an impact on the amount of birth trauma for a mum, and we can't eliminate birth trauma. They will be traumatised by a difficult situation in theatre, but it certainly doesn't help if we're not communicating well, and we can make a difference. And also, it has a stress on us. And a lot of people are doing the right things, but they don't know whether they're doing the right things. So when we did the survey, a lot of people actually employ great strategies already. And anaesthetists, I think for our reputation in the past of not being people that like talking to people, is a load of nonsense. And actually, we are largely very good and doing the right things, but people don't have the confidence that they are doing the right things. We're hoping that this communication tool will give them the confidence. You are barking up the right tree. This is what parents want, and it will give them the confidence to do, you know, what they're already doing, or to drive it up a little bit better. In terms of advice for, well, the novice obstetric anaesthetist, but any anaesthetist that goes to labour ward and does obstetric theatre, is that essentially, it's really difficult communicating well, and it's okay to find it hard. I think we all find labour ward quite exhausting sometimes. I don't know about you guys, but like, I'm a cheerleader with a trial of instrumentation because I so want it to work and don't want to proceed to C-section. I don't know about you.
I want to deliver the birth preferences that that mother and partner have come to the labour ward with, and I'm exactly the same. I'm right there pushing the back out.
Exactly.
Yeah. And
I put the headrest or the pillow up and I'm like, you can do it. You know, I actually quite like that, being the cheerleader, you know, but then appreciating when it doesn't work, you know, you're like, you gave it a really good go, well done, like, let's go up the bed and do this C-section. Yeah. Because they can find, you know, that thought of failure, you know, failure to do the trial, failure to progress. There's actually, you know, for women, that's not nice to feel I failed to progress. It's quite a loaded sentence, isn't it?
And I think those will be languages that will switch in 10 years. We'll realise, oh, maybe we should use slow to progress. And then that will change again in the further 10 years. But that's the beautiful thing about language, is it means different things to different generations.
Yeah, for sure. So as well as saying that it's okay to find it hard, I would say that minimising trauma is all about making people feel safe. When you're talking about trauma-informed care and minimising trauma for people, it is all about the feeling of psychological safety. And that goes for obstetric anaesthesia, normal general anaesthesia. I take it within intensive care, that if you can make people feel safe, they will feel less traumatised by something. And so that's kind of how I've set this guidance up, you know, to talk to you about today. Essentially, saying, I am here for you and I'm keeping you safe and your baby is having good care and they are being kept as safe as possible. That is the root of what will help minimise trauma.
Yeah, and what you've mentioned there, just to take a little bit of a step back. We use the term psychological safety and then we don't ever really define it.
Well, something that I do for ITU patients is like to make the family feel safe is I feel that it's important that I understand the patient as an individual and that gives them a feeling of psychological safety, that you're actually caring for their relative as an individual. So at the dying bed space, I try and ask the family, tell me something unique about this person in this bed space. Tell me about Ian. Was he the life and soul of the party? Was he not at the party? Was he an amazing violinist? Like, tell me something about him as a unique individual. And then sometimes they come up with an amazing fact, or like someone showed me a video of the patient that was dying in that bed space doing an amazing dance, like on TikTok. Ridiculous. But they were the life and soul of the party. But making the family feel that you're treating that patient as an individual is at the heart of them feeling safe with your care, because they feel like you're invested. And so that's something that I do, like, not within obstetrics, but in ITU. And something that, having had bereavement and having gone through the process, it's incredibly therapeutic to feel that your family's being cared for by people that care and that are invested in your loved one as an individual. In terms of back to the obstetric anaesthesia setting, in that same way, treating a baby as a much-loved individual is really important. And when I talk to people about how to discuss with parents, I would always advocate giving ownership to that family of that baby. So the baby is being resuscitated, is very medical, it's quite cold. Your baby is being given breathing support, or your daughter is being given breathing support, feels completely different. It's only a slight change in words, but it places that baby as an individual that is loved and cherished by that family. They can't be with them right now. They're off on the resuscitaire, but they are in ownership of that loved individual. And it just shows that you see them as part of that family unit. Does that make sense?
I think that's the difference between someone being your patient and that you are involving them. I think it's the same reason that you don't just call them mum or dad. You call them by their names. Would you suggest, if you knew the baby's name, to say that as well?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I think if you know the gender, use the gender. If you know their name, use their name. Anything that's identifiers is useful. If they say, my precious little one, you can echo it. You know, you can use their words and it shows that you're taking in how they view that baby and that you're seeing them in the same way. And giving the baby compliments is another way. You know, you don't know much about their personality yet, but you know if they have a big mop of brown hair. Juno had a big mop of brown hair and she was my brunette rock star, right? That's how I refer to her. And for people to say, oh my goodness, you're beautiful baby, like, look at that mop of hair, oh my word, they're trying to open their eyes. These are all things that show that you see that baby is an individual and that they are much loved. And I think it's just, it just shows the family that you care.
On that, we sometimes can take a bit of a overarching, we're trying to protect you mentality as the only person that's able to communicate with them as the anaesthetist. And we will try and say things that we think are reassuring, such as, oh, I'm sure it will be okay, or it's all fine. Does part of the project touch on that actually false reassurance isn't that helpful?
Yeah, that definitely came out. I think it's one thing if you can tell that it's very minor and the baby is likely to be with them imminently, you can say, oh, they're just having a quick check over, right? And they're going to be with you. But I think if there's uncertainty, what came out is that parents were saying, I don't want to be reassured that everything's going to be fine if it isn't, and I won't believe you. If you say everything's going to be okay and I can hear my baby's not crying, I'm probably not going to believe you. So what we're advocating as part of the support project and what will come on the infographic is there's nuance, like give assurances, not reassurances. So give assurances that your baby is having the correct care. What we would advocate is saying the right people are in the right place, having the right interventions. And you don't have to say those things, but, you know, the baby doctors are there. They're the right people to be treating your baby. They're giving your baby the support they need. And not everything going to be okay, especially if you don't know that. Yeah. And it's okay not to know.
And that's what one of the questions that Jim Bamber asked you at the OAA meeting was, that actually as an anaesthetist, sometimes we don't know, but we probably have a better idea, right, than the mother and the father, and we can pass on what we do know, even if we're unsure.
And I think that was something in the staff survey, what came out was people really worrying about not knowing the outcome and not wanting to say the wrong thing and not wanting to say, well, that things are going to be fine if they're not, but also finding it quite distressing that they don't know what will be the outcome. But the reality is even the neonatal doctors will probably not know how things will go for that baby. And we're not used to that much uncertainty as anaesthetists. We don't deal with that much uncertainty, diagnostic uncertainty and into the future. Actually, it's okay not to know. And you just got to own that and just say, if they say, is everything going to be fine? They want you to say,
everything's going to be fine.
But if it's not true, don't say it. If you don't know, just say, I don't know. Your baby is having the best care in the right place. You know, the right people are doing the right things for them. And the baby doctors or the neonatal doctors are going to update you as soon as they can. And I'm really sorry that I can't give you more information than that, but I don't want to tell you the wrong thing. So let's leave it to the specialists. You know, that's all right to own that. And even the neonatal doctors later may come and say, I don't know what will be, but they're having the treatment that they need. They're going to the neonatal unit.
I think that's a really powerful tool to arm, because I think going back to, you know, people about to start on labour ward, whether it's as a novice obstetric period or whether it's they haven't been on labour ward for a long time, all of what you said is fantastic advice, but where there's so much focus on getting the procedure right and going for an emergency, how could someone new to the setting drill this in? And I think we talked about timing before we started recording of, you know, you could start these sort of, just circling back to sort of empowering people, saying your baby, you know, and you, the fact if you're going for an emergency C-section where there is fetal distress, saying your baby is going to go to the neonatal team, the pediatric, the baby doctors, they're going to look after them whilst I'm looking after you. We will try and keep you updated. And that forewarning and drilling that in early before the moments happened can avoid that language slipping.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I think we've set out the infographic in a timing-wise direction because it's the most practical way to do it. And so we have formed pre-resuscitation phase, intra-resuscitation, what you can do, and post-resuscitation. For the pre-resuscitation, what I would say is that, like you say, for any emergency, they're going to go to the paediatricians, aren't they? They're not going to come and have skin on skin straight away. So for any emergency in obstetric theatres, you should be laying out the expectations. This, you know, this is an emergency as standard. Your baby will go and be with the baby doctors. They will be checked over on the resuscitaire. If you can locate the resuscitaire within the room, because they don't know what it is and what it's for, tell them what it's for. So this is a heated area where your baby can be checked over and have support if they need it. And to lay out, the parents feel like their baby's being whisked away unexpectedly. It at least shouldn't be unexpected. So if they can expect that that's the normal way of things, it's less traumatizing because it's, you know, an expected standard. And then also, I think it's super helpful. The WHO checklist is obviously a safety thing for theatres, but it's not set up for parents. So what I think is helpful and what we'll advocate on here as well before you get cracking with the delivery of the baby is that essentially, in minor terms, you know, in brief, laying out who's in the room, but not 5,000 members of the theatre team and everyone mumbling that they're scrub, is less helpful. What I like to do is to say, you know, I'm your anaesthetist and this is my ODP. We are here for you at the head end. The paediatric doctors are stationed at the resuscitaire. They are here for your baby and the midwife. The obstetricians are the other side of the curtain and they'll be operating on you. And that, I know it sounds like incredibly simple to us, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But why would they know that?
No.
Unless we lay it out for them. So just to say there's three groups in here. I'm here for you. The baby doctors are here for your baby and the obstetricians are operating on you. It sounds like, it's not rocket science, is it?
Yeah. But, no, not at all.
But at least it hones down who the roles, you know, what the roles are in that room, who's doing what. And it lays out, I'm your anaesthetist, my name's Esther, and I'm here for you. It breaks down that barrier and invites them to give questions or whatever, and it makes them feel safer.
Yeah, and it's a very simple but powerful thing, I think you said there. Like, having had my own recent obstetric experience with my wife, she actually found the WHO checklist the most bizarre thing in the world. She was like, why is there this weird roll call? Like, do people not know who they are? Like, I was just like, well, it's a safety thing.
Yeah.
That, like, that changes the face of that completely.
Exactly. I'm Colin and I'm Scrub. You know, it's not a helpful thing for the parents. It, you know, it's obviously necessary.
Yeah.
But it's a medical intervention. It's not actually honed to what they need to know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I also dislike that we, when we're doing OBS, feel that we can skip out parts of that, such as a big team introduction or not actually empowering the parents on it and getting the mum to shout out her own name or the father to shout out their name and their role.
Yeah.
And as part of the conversation, I recently got nominated for excellence by a patient's family and they said his communication was very good throughout the whole thing.
I know.
I was telling you up my own arse. But the only thing I could think I did during that case that my colleagues don't do is I make the father say their name. Then we end on the most important person in the room, which is the mother.
Mm.
And then otherwise it feels like we're having a separate experience to the two people that aren't being involved in it, if that makes sense.
I mean, fathers is another whole topic in itself. Mm. I honestly think fathers get so ignored.
Yeah,
and
completely agree.
Often just not treated like even someone in the room, isn't it? Because it's a very female-centric area, and obviously the mum is our primary patient, but the dad sometimes just gets forgotten or ushered away like some spare part when he is usually the dad of the baby. Yeah.
And other birthing partners are available.
And they get ignored. And it's so nice to involve them, isn't it? And for you to know their name.
Yeah, not call them dad or mum or or grandma. Otherwise, you are using a generic term, whereas you said that you're almost showing that you're not taking that time to care.
Yeah.
That's when you were talking about the delivery. That's actually one of the things I get the birthing partner to do, is help prop up the shoulder whilst I'm... Yeah.
Right.
So I've got one... It's terrible for a podcast as I'm sort of demonstrating it. I've got one hand on the right, one hand here, and then I get them to do... So if they don't really do it properly, it doesn't really matter. But at the same time, they're feeling that they're supporting, pushing up.
Yeah, nice. They've got a role in the room.
Yeah.
And I think that's something as well with this advice during resuscitation... Inviting breaking down of barriers and inviting the dad or the birthing partner to go and attend the resuscitaire can be really therapeutic, really nice thing to do, as long as the neonatal doctors, you know, are happy with that. I think it's good to choose the timing, and it could be worth asking the ODP to go and maybe check if it's all right for them to attend. Inviting that dad or that birthing partner to go over and to see what's happening and to see the care, if they can't see it when they're stationed by the mum, is massively important. And also inviting them to be able to take photos if it's an appropriate time for that, still allowing like photos even though it's a difficult time. I would say photographs are precious, and we had a photograph of Juno in theatre just after she was intubated. And, you know, it's got medical stuff. There's a person with medical gloves on. But it is one of the most precious photos that I have in my entire existence. And there's two photos that I have particularly of Juno that I love. And it is that one from theatre, and one that she had as soon as she'd arrived on the neonatal unit. And in both of them, she's intubated, she's got ECG pads on. You know, it's not the pristine photo that one would hope for, but it is all that I have. And it is before she had loads of fluid, got very edematous and become more and more poorly. And she looks like how I imagine that she would have looked in health. And for people that have stillborn babies, they don't even have that privilege. And I know that if we'd have been later, she could have been stillborn and I wouldn't have any pictures in life at all, only in death. So I count those as precious. And what I would say is that even if it's not quite the photo that they had wanted, it is so, so important for that family to have photos, and then they can do with them what they will. And if the baby gets better and they want to delete them and forget all about it or whatever, it doesn't matter. But, you know, for me, having had her just born, looking fabulous with her brown hair, you know, they are the photos that I show people and say, this is my daughter Juno, and I'm super proud of her. And I'm ever grateful that they got taken.
Firstly, that's very moving. And that sounds like you had a team that tried to involve you and your partner as much as they could, because without that, and that's why it's so good, the support project hopefully will be able to provide guidance. Without that, there is a probably discrepancy between practitioners as to whether or not they would bring the family in, and the more you leave a family out of it, it shows that it does contribute, as you mentioned, to birth trauma. And there's been quite a few different studies about family presence during resuscitation, and there is evidence to show that if done correctly, where you have someone who's explaining what's going on at the time, it reduces the PTSD scorings.
Yeah.
And that was on a recent Cochrane review that we'll put into the bio notes as well.
It's not something you ever wanted to see, but it's better to see it than to not. So you're absolutely right. Like, to be able to see the efforts being put in, even if it's not what you wanted and it's not, you know, that it's devastating, you can see the team were caring for your baby. You can see what interventions were needed. Unfortunately, in a lot of theatres, you can't see, isn't it, what's going on. And sometimes it's even behind closed doors. And the logistics is just impossible to get around. And photos can help, and inviting dad to or birth partner to attend the resus tech can help bridge that gap. And then they can take the photo back to the mum if she's well enough to look at it and appreciate what her baby looks like, even though they're not there. I would massively advocate breaking down barriers as you can. A drive-by on the way up to the NICU. Obviously, if they return to the family, fantastic, isn't it? And usually they're in dad's arms, then cutched up in a blanket, and you know, the mum can engage with, she might feel a bit rubbish, isn't it? But can engage with having the baby nearby. But if not, I would definitely encourage your neonatal team if they can get the baby to come via the incubator and, you know, actually there'd be a visit before they go up to the neonatal unit.
Physical contact.
Yeah, some physical contact, even a touching of a hand. Even, it might seem minor to you, but, you know, for that family, having some skin on skin, you know, may not be possible in the way that they wanted with straight on the chest. Still holding a hand, stroking a belly, it all helps bring some normality into a highly abnormal and unexpected situation.
And it's, again, it's empowering and involving the mum and dad in a situation where even you as the anaesthetist can feel powerless.
Yeah.
And not fully informed, like you said, isn't it? It's assurance and Absolutely. Saying, look, let's see if we can get you seeing baby. Let's see if we can get a photo.
Yeah, you know. So that follows on to, like, my post advice, if I go to the infographic. Encouraging the neonatal team to come and, in brief, explain what support was needed. It doesn't have to be much. In fact, I would advocate that it's not the right time to go and talk about cooling of the brain or anything beyond the immediate, because that family will be in total shock. And just having, okay, they needed some breathing support, they're a lot better now, they might need a bit of oxygen. You know, something in brief of what support has been required. Where do we go from here? You know, are they going to the neonatal unit? Are they staying with you? Do they need any, you know, additional support going forward? Again, the opportunity for a photo once you're together as a family. Fantastic. And then just remember that it's a whirlwind and you may be having to have eight hands, isn't it, with the flattening of the bed, the oxytocin, the infusion, everything going on. Mum's probably not that well if the baby's poorly, isn't it? It's reality.
Yeah.
And you're usually tied up trying to do your paperwork. It's difficult. And you may feel that you didn't do the best job at the time, and that's okay. We're only human. If you feel that it would be beneficial, talking to them afterwards is still an option. I know we like to move on to the next thing, and often in obstetrics, there's another thing, isn't there? There's another room and another epidural. But if you can attend even for 5 minutes after they've left theatre and just briefly do a quick debrief, it might be helpful for you to feel like you've done a better job of the communication, and just to say, this is what happened, you know, and you lost a bit more blood than usual, your baby needed a bit more support, this is where we go from here, I've been really privileged to be involved with your care. And it may only take 2 minutes, but it might make you feel that you've done a better job of the communication when it was an absolute chaotic time in theatre and you weren't able to do.
You even saying that has made me, there's two cases that come to my mind that I was fairly distraught afterwards and I didn't know what to do in terms of going to that communication. I now wish that I had, actually, because I'd formed quite a bond with the parents and not them finishing that off and giving them time to space and to talk. I think would have helped both their journey and mine a bit. But obviously it's in the right place, isn't it?
And it's not always possible. And sometimes you've got a whole stack of other things to do that are urgent and it just goes by the wayside. And that is just sometimes the way it goes. And it's not to chastise yourself for that, but if it's possible. And it leads on as well within our infographic about supporting ourselves.
Very important.
Super important. And we are often not very kind to ourselves, are we? And we think we should be able to just crack on. It's not very nice going through this as a staff member, is it?
Yeah.
No, because you get involved in medicine to make people better, and for there to be someone so young and so vulnerable that you've assisted in their care, not be in their mother's arms feels, as an anaesthetist, sometimes a bit like a failure. But actually, you're there to... You can't make everything great, and you're there to make someone have the best experience possible, and that does involve being involved in these situations and trying to get away from the perfect outcomes for everyone is quite important. You turn up to do your best at work.
Yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? An anaesthetist, we get cultured to be perfectionists, and this is a obstetric anaesthesia is a you can never get perfect, really, can you?
No.
You can aim for it.
You can aim for it, but yeah. Exactly. It's perfect is the enemy of good. You've got to do the best you can with what you've got.
And during the novice period, I tell every novice that I come across, I say, look, starting anaesthetics is very difficult because your enjoyment and fulfillment from a day will pin on whether you got the eye gel in, whether you got your cannula successfully, and whether you intubated an esophagus. And if you can't put the LMA in, fail your cannula and do an esophageal intubation, you go home and you feel rubbish. But it's nothing to do with you or how you are tomorrow. But we're pinned on procedural success.
Yeah.
And outcome success is normal for us, isn't it? We're in a high-stakes game, but usually it goes very well.
Yeah.
And we're not used to dealing with things going badly unless you're in intensive care, and you're dealt a difficult hand. So, yeah, it's rubbish, isn't it? Yeah. When the baby's born poorly or the mum isn't satisfied and the pain relief wasn't good and the epidural didn't top up so nice, and it can be really frustrating.
Yeah.
And people dwell on it afterwards. And the staff impact was big, you could see. People going home worrying about it, worrying if they had any part in the poor outcome.
Yeah.
The reality is, unless you've taken, far longer over a spinal that should have been a single shot and then a GA, the reality is we're likely to not impact too much, isn't it, on the outcome, thankfully. But we do obviously worry about that if things don't go well, we worry about our part in it.
Were there suggestions from the support project in how we can safely support ourselves and our staff members via debriefs or conversations?
We've tried to keep it super pragmatic because if you aim for something unachievable, it's going to be ignored, isn't it? So all we've put on the sheet really is that think about yourself. Do you need a quick cup of tea? Is there time for a quick sit down? And just thinking about yourself for a few minutes before you move on to the next thing, because these are difficult situations and they take their toll. It might be that you just have to crack on and move on, but maybe later in the shift, take a moment. Yeah, is there an opportunity for a debrief? Would it be a hot debrief? Would it be helpful? We've just given a nod to it. We haven't said how to do it. There's lots of tools out there of how to do it.
The back of the QRH Ops handbook. That's quite a structure if you're not used to debriefing.
I figured that different trusts might have different ways and better to just give a nod to it and say, do you need to do it? Have you documented what you need to? Because when I'm talking to people about just in general difficult situations and how I approach it, as SR on call, I always make sure that my paperwork is okay before I leave the shift, because I'll go home and I'll stew over what I didn't write down. So just making sure that you document things on that OBS chart, if there was something a bit untoward or, something you think's useful, because it helps you sign it off in your brain and helps you offload it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they're the main things, really.
This is something that's been needed and it's going to help a lot of people. So thank you for all your hard work with it.
No problem. I'm really keen to not make it rocket science, but also to bring some nuance, that it's maybe seems simple, but maybe things that people didn't know were important to do. I don't know. It's very difficult for me because I've been on the other side and I understand it too well. So hopefully it's been informative. And hopefully everyone can take something away that they might do slightly differently next time.
I'm going to make sure, I thought I did this, but I'm really going to actively ensure I'm using the word your.
Yeah.
I'm not going to use the word resuscitator. I'm going to say, I'll say the resuscitator and I'll define what it is.
I think it's okay to say resuscitator, just to explain what it is.
And then the third thing is, I'm going to be very conscious about using bagging.
We're just putting your baby in a Tesco bag.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they'll be with you shortly.
Duncan, what were you going to take away?
I'd have to echo what you said. The power of saying you're introducing mum and dad as individuals, and also changing what the WHO check is. Changing it to, you know, you do have to do that roll call, but then saying, I'm here for you.
Mm-hmm.
They are here for your baby. The surgeons are here to do the surgery and get the job done as safely as possible.
Yeah.
I think that again changes that dynamic. And again, it's that feeling of safety and feeling of empowering mum and birth partner.
Isn't it so simple to us? But it just might not be obvious to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think particularly for us, the challenge is doing that at 3 a.m. when it's your fourth case of the night. You've been running around, you haven't had a break. So drilling it in and making it a natural part of your flow is very important.
That's also the I know that these aren't, and I'm going to say, we're in the college, we're recording during the day, so we're speaking from a position of privilege. That is the importance of having a cup of tea for 5 minutes in between cases, so you give yourself that bandwidth to be able to put someone in that psychological safety and look after their patient safety as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. If there's one more thing to do as well, try and bring your ODP along for the ride and use them. I think they often feel quite powerless and like they want to help. Tasking them with finding out whether the dad can attend the resuscitator or whether that it's okay to take a photo, giving them some communication to do, they're great as well, isn't it? And they are like an amazing asset within our team. Just utilise them, because if we're overburdened with the chaos of caring for a sick mother, they're often overburdened as well with the chaos of a sick mother, but we may be able to use them. And don't forget that they're a really useful member of our team.
Yeah.
I think that is another top tip that we'll be leaving with. What would you want a novice or an obstetric anaesthetist who's listening to this conversation come away with?
I think I would want to say, as I said earlier, that it's hard, it's okay to find it difficult. Obstetric anaesthetics is a highly emotionally burdensome specialty where you have to go through the highs and lows of that patient's journey, and it's all right to find it exhausting. That simple things can make a difference, as we've talked about. Your baby, your daughter is being cared for, they're in the right place, they're having the right care, you're safe. All these things may feel simple, but they make a difference. And in terms of a novice starting who is bricking it right before their first on-call, to tell them that they have the skill set that they need to deliver great care on the labour ward, and that they have the communication skills to do a good job, and that you can do it. You know, you can make a positive difference for that family. You may be quiet or loud, you may be a chatter, you know, you can bring your own personality and be true to yourself and do a great job, and every anaesthetist will do that slightly differently. But if you treat that family as a much cared for family, you treat that baby as an individual, and you invite the family's questions, you make them feel safe, you will be doing an amazing job for them. And they won't be able to tell you. You won't get the feedback that you want. You know, they could be crying their eyes out and you could be doing a brilliant job. They could be numb and give you nothing because they're in shock. They could be smiling at you as if you're doing a great job and you could be doing terribly. So there's actually no way of you knowing whether you're doing a good job or not. So I would just honestly put yourself in the mind of the parents, think of what they would want, make them feel safe, make them feel cared for, and you will be doing the best for them. And hopefully soon, use the infographic that, fingers crossed, will be on an anaesthetic machine near you.
And just thinking about Juno, How would you like her to be remembered, and what would you like her legacy to be?
I think I would want to say that she was and is a much loved and precious individual, that I love her as much as my children that are alive, even though she has not been with me now, you know, since 2017. That she was, yeah, my brunette rock star with a mop of brown hair, £8.13, and she loved spicy food in utero. And just, yeah, I would want her legacy to be that hopefully people around the country will have slightly better communication, and they're probably already having great communication. And I want to really reassure people that when we did the staff survey, people are doing a good job largely. Like, honestly, I think we are good at what we do. But if I can, you know, this Juno-inspired project, if it can make a difference for those families, feel a little bit better about this traumatising time, I'd just be super proud of her for being a part of that. And, you know, hopefully for the years to come, essentially.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time today, Esther.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
No.
I feel really privileged to have come and shared, and thanks so much for having me. It's been great.
Thank you again to Esther for sharing her and Juno's story and the learnings from it, that she has changed into a butterfly effect in the support project. As we mentioned in the intro, the support project is still awaiting publication, so we have a link to the website where it'll be uploaded when it is in the bio. In the bio, we have links to some resources about neonatal resuscitation. We have the OBS QRH OAA guide, which on page 9 has a debrief tool. And then we have two wellbeing resources. One is the RCOA Wellbeing Hub, and the other is BMA Doc Health. And I think it's important to mention that these events can have an impact on us as carers and doctors and patient advocates. And it sometimes is important to debrief with a team member, and sometimes you need to go and talk to someone else about it. We are humans that do extraordinary things, not extraordinary humans that do extraordinary things. And I think it's important to recognise that and the impact that dealing with some of these events can have. I'll just finish by thanking everyone from the support project. There was never a guideline when I started out, and you just go and do your best and you spend the rest of your shift and maybe time after the shift thinking about it. Did I say the right thing? Have I helped them in their journey? And I think having a guideline and a body of evidence to help support that can really help you as a doctor or healthcare professional be reassured that you are doing the right thing. So thank you again to Juno, Esther, and the support team. And lastly, thank you for being a listener during season 2 NovPods, your beginner's guide to obstetric anaesthetics. Duncan, Rosie, and I hope it's been useful, and we wish you all the best in your obstetric anaesthetics journey. Bye bye for now. We'll be right back.